Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update on this Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Oh, good morning.
Hey, could you join me in wishing a happy birthday? The first day of Chanukah is the birthday of Gveret Shoshana Weingarten. So could you join me in wishing her a happy birthday?
Grand Lady of the Weingarten family.
There you go.
Pleasure to wish her a very happy birthday. At least they can't forget her birthday when it comes to the day before Hanukkah.
Well, yeah, it's actually the first.
They give her an extra gift.
I believe it's actually the first day of Hanukkah. That is the greatest birthday. All right, lots in the news, as we know. Boy, there is a lot happening and a lot going on. The week, I guess the news week for us, began right after we left the air last Friday morning, when it was announced that there will now be a building, the area in E1, so to speak, between East Jerusalem and Maale Adumim, is now going to be zoned, and they will move forward in terms of building in that area. You know what the reaction was to the Prime Minister and to the government of Israel from folks around the world, including Washington, and there were threats about ambassadorships from certain countries, etc., etc. So, Malcolm, is this announcement about housing and building a big deal or not?
Well, it's been made a very big deal, so now it's become a cutting-edge issue and a rallying point for many of those who had expressed sympathy for Israel during the war. Quickly reverted to true form.
Yeah, boy.
And the truth is that it's a tempest in a teapot, because Israel is not building in E1. And people should know, E1 is a 5 square miles between Maale Adumim, a city of almost 40,000 people, a suburb of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem. It's connected right now by one road. That's an impossible situation. It's also critical in terms of defense, again, in the Jordan Valley, because if troops need to move towards the Jordan Valley, you will need the facility, the access routes. At the same time, you need to have for regular transport. So this area is very critical. Going back to Rabin talked about building there, Olmert talked about building there, despite his outrageous comments during the last
week. We'll get to that.
And E1 itself is essentially barren land. The steps that were taken now are only about zoning. It's not about any real change in the status of the area itself. And Israel is paying a price now for a hypothetical thing. I think that many people feel it's a mistake to link it to the punitive measures being taken against the Palestinian Authority for what they did at the UN, because this is a matter of right for Israel, that building the settlements is in accord with the agreements, and these areas are areas that are expected to remain with Jerusalem, with Israel, no matter what.
But the timing wasn't a coincidence, was it?
No, not at all, and that's the problem, that people say, well, if you make it a punitive measure, anytime you put up a building there, they'll say this is a punishment, not a matter of security or of right. And also the argument that is made that there won't be contiguity, which nobody knows what that means, but it means that there would be continuous access, that the different parts of the Palestinian territories will be connected to one another, something that they've insisted on and which was accepted as one of the principles. That's easily achievable with bypass roads and tunnels and other things, so that the east-west and north-south routes would be able to continue and it is not an obstacle as they as has been asserted.
Right. But I'm confused with the geography here, because you're saying it's not E1, but then you're saying it is. So
no, it is E1. Absolutely, E1 is just the designation of the area between Maale Adumim,
right,
and that it's a land bridge between Maale Adumim and Israel,
right,
Jerusalem. This area, which now the Palestinians say they're ready to go to the International Criminal Court over something, you know, was one of the concerns that we expressed all along about their move at the General Assembly. When people say, "Well, it doesn't really change anything," this is one of the possible consequences. That they will go there against the settlements, and especially about E1, and the international community bought into the charge, and the reaction is such an overreaction. So the argument is made that the timing was wrong. There were other measures. You cut the taxes you transfer. There are other measures that could have been taken. And especially because you're not actually constructing, you're just talking about zoning and preparing to construct.
Has Israel ever zoned in other E1 areas?
E1 is one block.
And that's it. That's the whole E1.
That area, which is the equivalent of about 5 square miles, is just one area that links. E1 is like on a map where you have E and 1 coming together. You know,
that's so, it.
That's it's just a designation.
I guess depending on the size of the map. So joint areas, right? The joint security, supposedly, you know, that where both Israel and the PA are responsible. That's a
right.
much larger area. That's in many different parts of Israel.
See, this is exactly the point that has been lost, and few people have made it. That all of the settlements, the areas that are being constructed on, are about 7%, and actually 5% are being built on, of the whole West Bank. That's it. So E1 added to it does not increase the percentage significantly, and they've always said that there would be a swap involved for the land.
They're just panicking about the contiguity, that's all. I mean, that's, you know.
And now they made an issue of it, and they made E1, and I guarantee you for 90% of those who have been critical, if you would give them a map, and say, okay, can you describe E1? Can you show me E1? And why would it be the obstacle that you're painting it as? Again, one can argue and discuss whether the announcement was the timing was right, was right, that was right.
It was the same arguments we heard with Har Choma, right? Same thing.
We've heard the same arguments about Har Choma. This is a little bit more sensitive, and there were many plans to build police stations there, other things, and each time the government's come to the pressure. If 18 years ago, when this was first mapped out and the plans were to build there, had they gone ahead with it, today you would have a different reality on the ground.
All right. Were you surprised that certain countries were talking about the withdrawing ambassadorships and calling the Israeli representatives to their office to be spoken to in all this?
I'm not sure it's true that anybody really threatened to withdraw the ambassador. This was a story that appeared in Haaretz. From what I've heard and from people I spoke to, that there was nobody who actually threatened to withdraw their ambassador. Some were called in for consultations at their home government. Some were yelled at, I'm sure, and the concerns of their governments were communicated in very strong terms. But as far as I know, there was not an attempt to actually call back or break their relationship.
And the truth is that to me, as the casual reader of news, Great Britain, French, and German reaction was pretty clear. I said earlier Washington reacted, but I'm not. I mean, it was basically the same usual thing, right, about the timing, and we questioned.
Always the same, and you see how quick they are with such public denunciations. We didn't hear from many of them the kind of denunciation when 800 rockets were falling on civilian populations for the first 6-7
What do you mean? Every Jewish leader was praising the president for how outgoing and outspoken he was on that issue, supporting Israel and saying how it had a right to defend itself.
No,
what do you mean?
I said I wasn't talking about the United States.
Oh.
I was talking about many of the others who were not heard from during all the time of the bombings, the rocketing, and the, you know, that it's always a one-sided reaction, and I think it's out of proportion, and maybe Israel didn't communicate it well, and again, you can question.
So I don't even get
raise
to
many questions about it, but
so I don't even get to do my sarcasm about the U.S. support for the war. Oh well,
okay. wish to do it.
Well, I'd like to, because everyone, you know, praised the president. I thought, you know, the U.S. reaction could have been even a little better, but all right, you know, I guess we got to take what we can, you know.
But they did call in the ambassadors, but if you saw yesterday, Merkel met with Netanyahu, and they came out, and she said, we agreed to disagree over the settlements.
Yeah.
You know,
not quite sure what that means, but okay.
Right, but it doesn't undo this rush to judgment. And the Palestinians now are exploiting it.
There'll still be a German ambassador to Israel.
And, you know, it becomes a rallying point for them. The fact that tunnels are back in operation, you don't hear that kind of reaction or that.
Why? There's another missile and rocket buildup going on?
There is the fear of another rocket buildup. Israel is monitoring this very carefully. Somebody told me that when you go down to the Gaza border, it sounds like you're in the midst of this massive raid by bugs because of the sound, the whirling sounds that are going on, which is drones flying over various areas along the Gaza border and Gaza itself, where Israel is monitoring, obviously, any import of weapons, which would be a violation of the ceasefire, and Israel itself has expressed its concern that Mashal is coming back, and they say they have no control over who comes from the Egyptian side into Gaza, but have talked about invalidating the ceasefire if, in fact, Islamic Jihad leaders and others come to Israel. So, I mean, I think that the Europeans never criticize Abbas, who praised suicide bombers this week, who again engages in the kind of incitements that we see, who never said anything against the rockets, but in fact praised the rockets, even though they were falling on civilians, and they accused Israel of, he accused Israel of tunneling under the Temple Mount, the Harbayah, to destroy Al-Aqsa. I mean, all sorts of incitement of a vicious nature, and you hear almost nothing. Everybody just dismisses it and talks about him as a man of peace. And so did some Israeli leaders at a time when he engages in this kind of rhetoric, which is certainly far from anything peaceful. And I think that, you know, it's interesting that countries like Britain and France, which still control territories across an ocean, you know, criticize Israel, which builds in its own capital.
That's true. I never thought of that. America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program. Heard and listen to sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. You ever feel like you're fighting an uphill battle, Malcolm? Especially when you see what Ehud Olmert said this week, and especially when you see how the press makes a very big deal about leadership in the Jewish community who came out specifically with praise for the PA declaration at the UN. How'd you feel when you read that?
Well, I think for a former prime minister who says that, you know, he's going to abide by the rules, which has always been that you don't criticize Israel from outside. When you're in Israel, you say what you want to, but when you travel abroad, the common decency was not to do it. And Ehud Olmert is a very smart guy. He's he just announced that he's not running, so this is not an electioneering on his part. It could be positioning on his part. But I think it's just inappropriate, and some of the statements that were made went so far beyond the right of people who want to dissent or want to disagree or criticize. And there were several rabbis of a synagogue in Manhattan that sent a letter and put out a statement that was really quite outrageous, and they backed off of it and said that parts of it were left out. As one commentator wrote, that the dog ate my homework excuse, that somehow, you know, it was put out and he didn't put in the contrary and the countervailing comments. But this rush to judge, this rush to criticize, after all that Israel has been through, and again, Israel's not above criticism, and it's a political silly season, and things are said and things are done that sometimes, you know, you scratch your head about. But I think people have to be more careful. They have to think about the consequences of their actions. And you don't play out the Israeli political competition here in the United States.
We'll get to the Israeli political scene. I don't remember so much movement this close to an election ever, at least as far as I've been following Israeli elections. We'll discuss that in a moment. First, you got to help me out with what's going on in Egypt. So there are rallies and protests in the streets that are anti-Morsi. Yet the media has told us that based on the election and many other factors, the majority of people in Egypt are Morsi fans. So what's going on over there?
Well, what we're seeing is demonstrations that are approaching the size of those that were against Mubarak. And you have different factions that are now competing, those pro-Morsi, those anti-Morsi. Morsi changed the constitution. He was really a power grab, and he announced the first measures that he was taking, unilateral measures. When he went after the army, they were quiet. When he went after the media, and he removed, as I reported here, in one day 50 editors and all the other steps he took to take control over the media, it was quiet.
Right.
It's interesting that when he moved against the judges, then they reacted. And because their role is protected in the constitution, and because they are independent, and they refused to acquiesce quietly, and all of a sudden that triggered a reaction. And then they had on Friday night an all-night session where they came up with a constitution and they passed it, and they're going to have a referendum on the 15th of December where they're supposed to ratify it in a public referendum. And the fact is that people saw that it denies women's rights, it denies protections to minorities and many other things. And you began to see the reaction, and the reaction is in part those who had hoped for a different future, who see this as a reversion to Mubarak and worse. The army didn't react and now was brought in to protect the Morsi and to stabilize the situation in Cairo. But at this time, it's not just Cairo. It's all over Egypt, these demonstrations. But the reason is because the army's interests are protected in the Constitution. You know, they control about 30% of the economy, and their rights and their position is protected. So the judges, who are the ones who would be most impacted by the Constitution and who have always been more independent force, triggered this reaction, but it is increasingly popular, and you have a revolt, as someone said, of the hungry.
But people
did not see an improvement in the economic conditions that he had promised.
So that's how you would classify the protester. It's not those who are seeking democracy, it's those who are starving.
That's one element. There are people who are protesting against the power grab and against the positioning by Mr. Morsi, but you have to remember, Morsi was elected by a minority of the people, and then the vast majority of Egypt didn't even get involved, and they voted for him against the secular candidate, who, because he was a former prime minister under Mubarak, and they felt that he was the lesser of the evils at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now you see how the rhetoric changes. Now they're accusing even of a Zionist plot on the part of El-Baradei, who's now leading the opposition and is not without problems himself, having had a very close association and even reportedly paid association with Iran, Sabahi and Amr Moussa, formerly of the Arab League, that they're saying that they are in league, and there's a complaint that was filed with the public prosecutor that this was a Zionist plot. And the funniest part, as sad as it is that they claim that they secretly met with Tzipi Livni to bring the country to the knees, and they said that when the Qatari Emir went to Gaza, he gave gifts, pens and other things, and he said these were really broadcasting signals. That's how the Israelis were able to pinpoint the locations, and so he's part of the plot too.
Wow, very sophisticated.
Yes, only true.
We'll try to get to Syria and Iran. There's a lot to talk about this week, but first, do we now declare the Kadima Party dead? Is it officially gone or unofficially gone?
No, it's still running. They claim that they'll be stronger. They've lost seven members to the new party, to Livni. They lost people like Dagi Itzik, a former speaker of the Knesset.
What's more alive, the Labor Party or the Kadima Party?
No, Labor is much more alive today, because Labor under Yachimovich is slated to get half a dozen seats, maybe five, seven. Nobody knows real numbers.
And Kadima?
Kadima is down to two or three.
That's it. So they're almost dead. They're not dead. They're almost dead.
They're almost dead. But, you know, Barak's party now is dead. The Independence Party is gone. And the number of defections, you made a reference to this kind of action.
Yeah, how much movement this close to the election?
This is a deadline now for people, for the list to be submitted.
Yeah, but there have been deadlines before. Do you remember anything, a press?
I do not recall. And the fact that Amir Peretz, the day before, which is from Labor to Livni, that I said to somebody, it's, you know, the proverbial switching of the seat, the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Right.
You see them reorganizing all these things amongst parties, and they are fighting each other, fighting others. You see the unhappiness in Likud about the order of that and how many seats Lieberman got. Lieberman shocked everybody by dropping unceremoniously Dani Ayalon and put Yair Shamir in his place.
Ayalon or Danone? It was Ayalon?
Danon is Likud. Ayalon, who was number two on his list and a deputy foreign minister who did a great job, he just dropped him.
And
Minister of Tourism, Stash Mezhnikov, everybody knew would be dropped. They embarrassed him. And
I'm so confused how this works. In other words, when they make deals at the primary time to be a certain number on the list, that can be adjusted? Someone can unilaterally just toss you down to, you know, a much larger number, a much lower number?
Well, in most of the parties, they have primaries, and then in the primaries dictate the order. But they're adjusted for one thing, to have enough women in the top five, and then the top 10, top 15, to have a Russian, to have an Ethiopian, to have others, some Haredi.
That's what happened to Feiglin last time with Likud?
that he was moved down because of that, and because Bibi wanted him further down on the list.
Right, but again,
but 1 second. But Lieberman did not have a primary. He set the order.
So he can do whatever he wants to the order.
Could do essentially what he wanted, but in all the other parties.
And why can't Bibi do that now with Likud? Do whatever he wants with the order.
Because you have a Likud rules, and the rules are that you.
But he violated the rules last time.
Absolutely, he manipulates the list. It will not end up the way the numbers essentially came out. There are many changes that take place, and then a lot of people get put in positions because when you have to integrate the Lieberman ticket in and all the other special considerations and everything else, people fall outside of the guaranteed seats, which let's say is 30 for Likud or 25.
And they go below that line.
That many people drop out. I mean, the number of people retiring from politics, the big name people, is really quite remarkable.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. All right, was there a USA drone that was taken out by Iran this week?
There's no evidence that they actually captured a drone. They haven't shown pictures of it, which they usually do. So until we actually see the pictures, it's hard to say. But they are acting with more and more impudence. You know, they did fire at a drone over international waters. They have taken other actions which are more aggressive, and also are proclaiming publicly that they are increasing the number of centrifuges. What's interesting this week is that the focus of attention on the Bushehr reactor, which is the one the Russians provided,
right,
which was supposedly proliferation resistant and would be monitored, and all of the spent fuel rods would be taken back to Russia, and that this was the safe one, and Russia was going to build many more, and they make $1 billion off of it. But what happened, as we've learned, is that in October, 2 months after it went operational, the Iranians removed these rods. Maybe it was a test run for future reprocessing of these rods, which would produce enough enriched uranium for 24 Nagasaki-type type bombs, if they go ahead with the construction. So the U.S. has announced that they are monitoring reactors more, I guess, with drones and other things, but that includes Bushehr, which had been more or less immune from much of the criticism. It was always focused on Fordo and these underground facilities. And they admit themselves that they are increasing the number of centrifuges every day and will continue to do so every day. We've seen new sanctions this week. The Senate voted 94-6. The administration did not support it because they felt that they didn't need it and it would interfere. But the Senate, led by Menendez of New Jersey and Mark Kirk of Illinois and others, took the lead and passed the sanctions, which hit the energy and port and shipping and other things. Another target right now of U.S. And this administration led is against Turkey, where we're seeing surging gold sales, which is a way for Iran to bypass the sanctions. Austria, so far this year, it's a record year for them to import oil from Iran. So we see, as important as the sanctions are, how easily they can be bypassed.
In addition to that, I didn't think that Iran could be less on the map here in the United States, on the media map, than it was during the debate season, and sure enough it is. I mean, nobody's talking about them.
Well, nobody was, but I think everybody will be. We're talking about a matter of a few months before decisions have to be made. And
Now and the inauguration, nobody's talking about
this. Well, we had the sanctions legislation, and the difference between the administration and members of the Senate, even of their own party, when you have a 94-0 vote, I think it's a pretty clear margin.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like the panic has set in yet, though. But it will, according to you.
Well, I hope not panic. I hope determined
urgency,
well thought out action. Clear thinking, because this is really we're seeing Iran also stepping up weapons shipments. We see them compromising the relationship through Iraq. You know, the Iraqi Maliki, the head, has always been seen as being in link with Iran. Now we find out that they were lying to the U.S., you know, which insisted on them in checking the planes that fly over. So they brought down two planes, but it seems that they tipped off the Iranians in advance, so they knew that there would be no weapons on it. And we're seeing the impact in Syria of the heated up role along its borders between Lebanon and Syria, and et cetera. But where you have Hezbollah being rearmed, continuing to be armed, and there are reports of the missiles that are arrayed and directed at Tel Aviv. And of course, the big story was the chemical weapons, but it obfuscates some of the other concerns, the heated clashes between groups within, and many of those funded by Iran.
The chemical weapons issue becomes a distraction. Well, this leads to my question before we go to your Hanukkah message. Is it possible, as some have written this week, that the U.S. and or Israel would get involved in a military fashion if, in fact, Syria used chemical weaponry against the rebels?
This is an absolute red line. The threat of chemical weapons is the use of the chemical weapons is very great, and especially because that I discussed this for months and months and months and maybe years about they have the largest right. Syria has the largest stockpile of chemical weapons in the world.
Right.
They also have biological, but the biological is very unstable. It's hard to weaponize and to maintain. Chemical weapons are supposedly being administered to warheads and artillery shells. This is the latest that I heard just yesterday, that reports are that these artillery shells. Again, a lot of these reports are speculative and not confirmed yet, but the question is why. Is it an act of desperation on the part of Assad that he would use these weapons against the rebels? Some people say he already did it. Some say his father used certain chemical weapons when he, in 1982, when he went against the people of Hama. Is it that he is putting these in artillery shells that if he sees himself having to withdraw, that he will take these weapons with him because they can still be used? The speculation is rife. It's something that Israel watches very carefully because these weapons falling into the hands of Hezbollah and other Islamic terrorist groups that are there has implications for the whole region. Some people say he moved these things to protect them and to put them in more secure locations. That may have been true. That does not appear necessarily to be the case now. And as his army is becoming more tired and worn down, that these sites could become more vulnerable. The tensions, by the way, between the jihadists and the Islamists and the rebels and different groups there is increasing also, and they say that will be the next war after if Assad falls. But the potential, the danger that this poses, and now you have NATO intervention being talked about. I don't think that's the case. I don't think you can bomb the way to secure these things. It would require ground operations. The putting of missiles in Turkey, maybe that's because Turkey plans to do something. But again, it would have to be, I think, from the ground, because you have the potential that if you explode a place, then you create a cloud of these toxic weapons, a toxic cloud of these chemical weapons, which could kill many people as well.
My gosh. Do you hear what you're saying? I mean, this is...
I hear it all the time.
Unbelievable. All right, we have so much still to do before 9 a.m. this morning. I turn to you for our Hanukkah message. You know it begins tomorrow night, Mr. Honline. What would you say in 5773 to the Jewish people regarding the upcoming holiday?
Well, then come to Beth Torah tomorrow night while I'll be speaking.
Where is that?
Torah in Flatbush on Ocean Parkway.
First night of Hanukkah? What are they serving?
I'm sure very good food. They're very wonderful hosts and people.
What time should I be there for their first jelly donut?
Hearing community, but
excuse me.
As well, they don't discriminate. I do think though that it's a time when people, with all the things that we discussed, and it's really imperative that people know the negative, but to also not lose sight of the miracles. And I just been thinking about it. That when you say the bracha Bayami Mohem Basmanazet, we thank God for the miracles in those days in our time. And you wonder, is it in those days or in our time? And the message is that the miracles of those days are happening now. Rabim Biyad Matim, Tamein Biyad Taharim, Rishon Biyad Sadiqim, when the few overcome the many, the righteous overcoming the evil. Just look at what's happened in our lifetimes, how we've seen Jewish communities that were written off have come back, that Israel can be threatened in ways that in the old days would have been, the outcome would have been unthinkable, that Israel is strong, that Israel can stand against these challenges, and while some things don't change, when you see the hatred of the world, when you see the kind of instant reactions, the fact is that the Jewish people are strong, we're seeing the miracles, We just have to open our eyes to them, and that will inspire us to know how much more of a difference each of us can make. And it should be a time now not to be depressed by the news or by arming you with the information. Our hope is that people will be motivated to speak out. We have Chris Smith going down to see Ostacher in Bolivia, and an immense turnaround where now all the judges and prosecutors, everybody has been arrested for the fraud they committed against this innocent guy who's sat a year and a half in the most horrific prison in the world and in conditions that are unthinkable. Now he's in a hospital. That situations that everybody, you know, writes off, we see that the outcomes are coming our way. We just have to recognize it and be strengthened to do more.
Very well said. Have a happy Hanukkah, and thanks so much for joining us.
Be well.
Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.